asked Pakistan to stop forced deportation of its nationals, but Islamabad defends its policy.
The decision is in exercise of Pakistan's sovereign domestic laws and compliant with applicable international law, norms and principles. It does not apply to individuals who enjoy refugee status who will continue to be generously hosted by Pakistan.
There are over 4 million Afghans living in Pakistan, but almost half of them undocumented. Islamabad says undocumented Afghans are involved in terrorism and other crimes.
Relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan is already tense over Kabul's refusal to stop cross-border militant attacks. Many believe the crackdown against the undocumented Afghans will further complicate their bilateral ties. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
As the Israeli regime presses ahead with its atrocities, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have held a general strike to express their condemnation. The shutdown brought busy life to a standstill, but protests and demonstrations were already organized all across the main cities. In one of those rallies, protesters marched to the headquarters of the United Nations in Ramallah, demanding an immediate stop to the genocide and ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians in Gaza.
These non-stop massacres in Gaza and the latest committed against the Jabalia refugee camp are a failed attempt to weaken the Palestinian resistance and break people's steadfastness. Fighting is continuing and the resistance groups are causing severe losses to the Israeli forces. And our people in the West Bank are also fighting the Israeli military measures and brutality.
We have the same occupation and we are the same people. Geography does not, you know, divide people. We are just the same. We are all targets. Whenever you are a Palestinian, you are a terrorist and you should be killed. People are killed for no reason and for nothing. So, you know, this is complete genocide. This is complete war crimes that should be stopped immediately, right now.
On the other hand, Israeli regime has escalated its military operations and incursions all over the occupied territories. 4 Palestinians were killed on Wednesday. 3 of them were martyred in Jenin during a military raid to the city and its refugee camp, and the 4th was killed in Tul Karim. The Israeli military has also used drones during this recent raid to Jenin. This assault has caused severe damage to a number of buildings and to the alleys. During the funeral procession of the martyrs, identified as fighters from Fatah's Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, mourners vowed to continue fighting and avenge the killing of Palestinians in Gaza and here in the West Bank. So far, 130 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank and over 2,000 have been wounded. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, almost 1,800 Palestinians were detained during the daily raids. And for the third week, entrances to most Palestinian villages, towns and cities have been blocked by military checkpoints, earth mounds, cement blocks and iron gates, preventing movement between them amid an increased Israeli crackdown. Palestinians say the heavy crackdown is meant to prevent them from engaging in different forms of anti-Israel activities. With the escalation of Israel's aggression on Gaza, the regime's military has also been stepping up violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Despite that, Palestinians in the West Bank say they would not back up from supporting their brothers and sisters in the Gaza Strip. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Just 90 minutes before a highly anticipated march across Paris last weekend against Israel's war atrocities in Gaza, local authorities suddenly revoked the permit for the protest. That gave police legal justification to use a tool of political repression not seen since the Yellow Vests: massive fines. Out of perhaps 4,000 people, 1,400 protesters were given fines of 135 euros each. That's a total of nearly 200,000 euros extracted from the pockets of peaceful demonstrators, many of whom did not even know about the last-minute banning of the protest. Some of the fines may be dropped due to the controversial cancellation, but the initial figures were widely relayed by the media. The use of mass fines is the latest example of how France has effectively criminalized public support of Palestine and also silenced dissent against what is widely perceived as one-sided support for Tel Aviv, despite war crimes which have shocked the world.
Ne sont que un des éléments.
We must recall that this is just one element of the French government's absolute support for Israel. We saw Macron recently suggest that the West's anti-ISIL coalition actually be used against the people of Gaza. He also sought a nationwide ban on all pro-Palestinian marches, has constantly waved a false flag of anti-Semitism, tried to ban the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign, and on and on.
Demonstrations against Israeli atrocities have effectively been banned nationwide since October 7th, with only two legal protests allowed thus far in the capital. Two protests are planned in Paris later this week, but many say it's difficult to trust that the government will consistently honor the rights to freedom of assembly and freedom of speech when it comes to Palestine. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The spokesperson for Yemen's armed forces has officially confirmed that Yemen has entered the war against Israel. In a televised TV address, General Yahya Sari stated that the Yemeni army launched a series of ballistic missiles and drones that targeted numerous locations in Israel.
Our armed forces launched a large batch of ballistic missiles and a large number of drones at various targets of the Israeli enemy. The Yemeni armed forces confirmed that this operation is the third operation in support of our oppressed brothers in Palestine and confirmed that we will continue to carry out more qualitative strikes with missiles and drones until the Israeli aggression stops.
According to the military spokesperson, the United States, along with some Arab states, have allowed Palestinians in Gaza to suffer daily massacres and a strangling blockade. He condemned these Arab states for refusing to mobilize their armies in order to save Palestinians.
The Arab and Islamic world were supposed to mobilize and protect the children and women of Palestine. This is a moral, Islamic, and humanitarian obligation. In response to this, the Yemeni army had no choice but to answer the call of the Yemeni people and all free people. With our faith in Allah, Yemen's armed forces decided to act now in order to support the Palestinians who are experiencing this historic form of oppression.
The declaration of war leaves Yemen to become the first Arab nation to declare war on Israel since the 1967 war. The 6 days of war ended with Israel expanding its occupation over more Palestinian territories. Muslims and Arabs across the region are praising the Yemeni army's missile and drone attacks against Israel. The question now is, will other Arab nations take action to try and bring an end to the genocide in Gaza, or will they remain silent? Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Thousands gathered in the Pakistani capital Islamabad for a massive rally in support of Palestine. All Islamic communities, including Shia and Sunni, came together to voice their strong condemnation of Israel's atrocities in Gaza. Pakistan's religio-political party Jamaat-e-Islami hosted Gaza Million March just a few miles away from the U.S. consulate in Islamabad to condemn Washington's role in supporting Israel's crimes.
Israel is brutally attacking the innocent people. Israel is brutally attacking with phosphorus bombs on the hospitals. And every day they kill 500, 600, even 1,000 children and kids and women and civilians. So there is no justification of such a genocide.
Similar rallies were held in other cities where people voiced their anger on what they call the criminal silence of the world on Israeli bombardment in Gaza that has killed thousands of men, women, and children in recent weeks.
Children have nothing to do with war or with hate.
this is implantation of hate within children as well, which is a very bad thing for people in the future. I would request all the leaders of the Muslim nations to rise. This is the time. We don't have enough time. We don't have any more time to rise and become united against all this, against the evil Israel.
The protesters demanded that legal proceedings be launched against Israel in the International Court of Justice for its ongoing crimes against humanity.
It's not a war. It's a proper genocide. It's a proper ethnic cleansing. And it is being followed by war crimes, proper war crimes, which is a crime not only according to Islam, but according to Geneva Convention, according to all the rules of the world. And, you know, this is not acceptable.
The protesters also called on the people of Pakistan to boycott pro-Israeli companies and make donations to the people of Palestine.
The continuous presence of Pakistani citizens at pro-Palestine rallies indicates their steadfast commitment to the Palestinian cause and their strong objection to the actions of the U.S. and its NATO allies who are supporting Israel's deadly strikes on Gaza. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Balfour Declaration, one of the most controversial and contested documents in the modern history. It was on this day in 1917 that the British government announced its support for the establishment of a, quote, national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. This was one of the main catalysts of the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948, and the conflict that ensued with the Zionist regime. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how not dealing with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict has resulted in what we are witnessing today. Another ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians in the making with the help of the U.S. First, let me introduce our guest. Chris Williamson, host of Palestine Declassified, joins us from Derby in the U.K. Daniel Yegish, author and researcher, joins us from Beirut.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Chris Williamson, I'll first start with you. When you take a look at this Balfour Declaration, perhaps you can give us a brief, historical perspective on that. But what I'm looking at back then is that Jews constituted less than 10% of the population at that time. What they wanted to do was they wanted to facilitate the immigration of these European Jews between 1992 and 1935. You then have the population that rose from 9% to nearly 27% of the total population. Of course, what you think about the importance as to the way that Balfour Declaration is really what has set forward what we're witnessing today in terms of the uprooting of the Palestinians from their land.
His hands are soaked in blood, and the decision that was taken, or the announcement that was made in the Balfour Declaration, I mean, they had morally no right to make such a declaration. I mean, one people giving the land of another people to a third set of people. I mean, it completely unacceptable, and of course, everything flows from that. Interesting, though, of course, one of the things that also was said in the Balfour Declaration, that nothing shall be done that may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. And that certainly hasn't been upheld in the intervening years. So, yeah, I mean, I think Britain is morally responsible for what's happening right now. And they're doubling down, aren't they? We're seeing the government and the opposition parties throwing their full support behind the genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza. It's a shocking state of affairs, and you know, I think many British people feel ashamed of our country right now, and that's why increasing numbers of people are expressing their solidarity. Unprecedented numbers indeed of people are showing their solidarity with the Palestinian people on the streets of London and most towns and cities throughout the land.
Indeed. Well, Daniel Yedrish, when you want to take a look at this Balfour Declaration, what it did was displaced and forcibly uprooted Palestinians. The homes were destroyed, and there's a lot of horrific stories that can be traced back to that time of what Palestinians had to experience. And is it fair to make a comparison to what is happening today, especially with the news that Israel and the U.S. Have planned a forcible displacement, which is against international law, of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip into, again, this is a something that they haven't come out and acknowledged that they will do, but it's on the drawing board, it appears. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip to go to Egypt, the ones in the occupied territories to go to Jordan, which, again, is a forced displacement. Is it fair to make a comparison in that way?
Yes, I do think it's fair, and I also think we look at the Balfour Declaration as one of the documents in the continuity of Western, of different forms of Western, in this case British violence against the indigenous Palestinian people. And the Balfour Declaration in particular didn't even mention Palestinians. It referred to them as non-Jewish people or population. So again, here we can see how Palestinians have been dehumanized early on, but it didn't even start with the Balfour Declaration. The early writings of Zionism already from, if we go back to the end of the 19th century, look at Palestinians, or if we want to speak in settler colonial terms, at the indigenous people as people who do not belong to this land, as people who are less than human, or not even as people at all. So the dehumanization of Palestinians and identifying the settlers as the owners of the land is obviously something that is constitutive to Zionism and stretches throughout its history. So the ongoing genocide of Gaza that is taking place today is a result of these of over a century of settler colonial violence on the indigenous people, with its goal being obviously for the settlers to take the land of the indigenous people, and in all of which the what is now recognized by much of the world as the state of Israel has constructed its entire identity and narrative on the expulsion of the indigenous people. So the genocide that is unfolding right now, in fact, did not start on October 7, when this current escalation and the bombardments and massacres of thousands of Palestinians are taking place, but it's actually inscribed into the ideology of Zionism, which requires the killing and the destruction of the indigenous land and the indigenous people in order for Zionism to unfold.
The stats that has come out, Chris Williamson, about the instances that are occurring in the occupied territories in terms of the settlers acting against the Palestinians are very alarming, because the rate has increased based on one particular tally, which the UN agency OCHA actually cited a few days back. You're looking at 15 communities, Palestinians, that at least 98 households comprising of 828 Palestinians, including 313 children, have been displaced based on this set of violence. Set of violence is not anything new, but it seems like obviously this is now what they are perceiving to be an opportune time for them to go after Palestinians in the form and manner that they are. What are we looking at there? Is that something that I'm guessing maybe perhaps is being done in conjunction with Israeli officials, people like Itamar Ben-Gvir?
Well, indeed it is. And we've often seen, haven't we, examples where the illegal settlers are being accompanied by Israeli military personnel in their pogroms against the Palestinian people. And, you know, the level of intimidation and violence and murder is completely out of control, far worse than we've seen for a very long time now. And, you know, the way in which the Israeli settlers act is that they kind of act as if, you know, with impunity, really, and aided and abetted, as I've said, by the Israeli security services, stepping up the number of arrests. I think I saw some figures earlier today. I think there's around 2,000 people now in administrative detention. And these are people who were just rounded up, basically taken hostage. No due process, no trial, no charges. And people are just thrown in these Israeli dungeons. It's a shocking state of affairs. And the number of injuries is huge. Well over 2,000 people have been injured. 132 people have been killed in the West Bank. And as you say, you know, well over 1,000 people displaced. You know, this is going on in conjunction with the genocide that's taking place in Gaza right now. And what sickens me, I've got to say, is the compliance, really, the connivance, frankly, of the Western powers. And, you know, it seems to me that, you know, maybe part of the agenda here is to gain access to the rich pickings, you know, in the sea off the Gaza coast. I understand that the Zionist entity has issued some gas exploration licenses to fossil fuel companies. You know, it seems that there is a desire to essentially evacuate the entire area of Gaza. And indeed, there was a think tank linked to the Likud party, linked to Benjamin Netanyahu, that actually recently prepared a report, you know, effectively talking about a final solution for the Palestinian question. In other words, as I say, to basically, you know, kill and expel the entire population of Gaza. I believe that, you know, the United States are complicit in this, and talking about if the, you know, the Egyptian authorities were to accept people from Gaza, there's some talk about them, Israel, you know, paying for the cost of that, and the United States wiping out Egypt's debt if they were to do so. I think the Egyptian authorities will be reluctant, notwithstanding the inducements, because the support of people, you know, on the ground for the Palestinian people, you know, in the region is around the world, but particularly in the region. And you know, I'm not sure that if they went down that track, they, you know, they would be able to hold that line. I suspect, you know, there would be, you know, people even in the military who would not tolerate that. But there are lots of messages apparently going out now from the Egyptian authorities to the military, urging them to, you know, be calm, not get involved, etc., and so on. So yeah, it's a real terrible state of affairs, and you know, the Western powers have a lot to answer for in their complicity with what's going on right now.
Indeed. And those are interesting points that you make there, which I've heard on more than one occasion now. But let's focus on where you're at, Daniel Yeges, in Beirut, where I'm sure people are very, very anxious to hear what the Hezbollah Secretary General has to say tomorrow. I'm sure that they are either going to attend or watch and to see what is going to be said. I mean, I've seen a couple of the teasers, and I'm sure they have meanings in it. Maybe you can tell us. But today, for the first time, two drones were used these attack drones by Hezbollah, which targeted Israeli positions on the border. We also know that for the first time, all Israeli sites on the southern border were targeted by the resistance fighters. Tell us what you think may happen. I know it's speculation, but you know, since you're there, perhaps you can give us a better idea of this.
Yeah, it's difficult to speculate, difficult to predict what is going to happen, but obviously there is anticipation for the speech that is scheduled for tomorrow, because it can have a lot of implications on how the situation is going to further unfold. But of course, we're currently almost 4 weeks into this war, and it's interesting to see how from the military side, it is different in many ways of the previous confrontations, and Hezbollah obviously continues to play a major role in the deterrence against the Zionist regime, which is, one could argue, also weakened internally to an extent where it isn't able to fight a war on two fronts, if we look at the current situation. However, of course, it is very difficult to speculate what the outcome of the speech will be, because it is an unprecedented situation for many people here and in the region, and a very uncertain situation as well.
Taking a look at the particular statement of genocide there, and I'm bringing this up because it needs to be discussed, Chris Williamson, UN has come out on saying that Palestinians face a risk of genocide. You know, this word has been echoed by several either leaders or politicians. Even the Iranian foreign minister has said that on more than one occasion. And I'm going to put that next to the fact that you have, over the course of this October 7th till now, 25,000 tons worth of explosives have been dropped on the territory. And the comparison has been made to the atomic bomb, I guess, that was dropped by the U.S. Of course, these bombs are made in the USA. And therefore, this whole complicity, which, by the way, I'm sure you're well aware, U.S. itself has a law by the name of the Lee Act, which doesn't allow the sale or assistance militarily to regimes that drop bombs on a civilian population, just like the way that Israel is doing. Doesn't that really put into perspective, or should I say, shows how the U.S. is complicit, really in a large degree, when it comes to this war?
Well, the U.S. just turns a blind eye when it suits it to do so. Quite clearly, the Zionist entity is in breach of that directive that you mentioned there. As we know, it's in breach of international law. But they just seem to have carte blanche to do as they wish. I mean, if the international law meant anything to these Western powers, then they would be bringing pressure to bear on Israel. And look, Israel couldn't survive were it not for the support of the United States, with its huge subsidy that it provides to Israel on an annual basis, and talk of even increasing that, and the support that they are providing in terms of the military hardware that you mentioned, the fact that they've actually floated two aircraft carriers into the Mediterranean also tells you a story, doesn't it? But, it seems to me that the whole question really is about the, as it were, strategic interests of the United States, and clearly they use Israel to further United States interests. And I've already mentioned the licenses to explore for gas reserves in the Mediterranean off the Gaza coast. And a bit like the NATO proxy war in Ukraine, in the end, a lot of this often comes down to the whole question of fossil fuels and the fossil fuel industry. And I think, though, that the public opinion in the United States is certainly turning increasingly in support of the Palestinian people and against the Israeli regime. You've even got senators now and members of the House of Representatives, actually openly criticizing AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, which is incredibly powerful in the U.S. And politicians have always been fearful of speaking out and criticizing Israel, and certainly not criticizing AIPAC because of the potential repercussions. But people are now, some of these politicians who've been livid in the past, are now speaking out. So, you know, opinion is changing. Whilst it's true that the leaders who hold the levers to power at the moment are very much still in the pocket of the Zionist entity, you know, public opinion around the Western world is changing. And even some of the politicians lower down the food chain, as it were, are flexing their muscles to some extent. And, you know, things, I think, are changing in terms of, you know, where politics is heading in terms of this question in the West. But, of course, you know, on the ground, the resistance is very, very well prepared. And I think, you know, will take its destiny into its own hands in the coming weeks.
Well, I'd like to find out how much they are changing, Daniel Yejish. We're looking at some of the political costs that are showing itself. One of the ones are Bahrain announcing the Israeli ambassador to have left the country, and that there has been a halt now to economic relations between Bahrain and Israel. We're also looking at how Bolivia has cut off diplomatic relations. But in the bigger picture, we're looking at how this whole image of Israel, as controversial, maybe, to lack of a better word, that it was, it's really lost somewhat of its legitimacy on the world stage. The protests obviously show that. Our guests there just talked about how politicians are more sympathetic towards now the Palestinian cause. But how much of an impact and damage has Israel suffered, and how much more is Israel risking to damage its whatever's left of its reputation or image by continuing this war?
So the question here also is who Israel's audience is. And it's a very good observation, of course, that Israel's public image has suffered to some extent. But of course, if we look at the support that Israel gets and we look at where it gets the support from, that's not necessarily based on any rational, ethical, or moral implications. The Israeli regime is supported by the governments of the European Union, of the United States, and other governments that emerge as settler colonies, including Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and their close allies, which represent basically not the majority of the world, but which have obviously a overproportional power on the international stage in the so-called international community. And obviously, given that the United States is in the UN Security Council, the Israeli regime, to some extent, has sort of a veto of power. So even before this current escalation and the genocide that we're seeing happening now, the Israeli regime was upheld by political elites, not necessarily by people around the world. So it is, of course, a shift to some extent to see that even though the Israeli regime has been investing so much money and efforts into its public diplomacy and different forms of propaganda to target in particular Western audiences, to identify itself as a victim, to identify itself as a so-called democracy, the only democracy in the Middle East, and to keep on recycling those Orientalist and very racist anti-Palestinian and anti-indigenous language and basically fantasies and myths. At the same time, those who support the Israeli regime at this point do so for various reasons that might be anti-indigenous and racist. And we see that obviously in the discourse that is peddled by the political elites in the European Union that keep on euphemizing genocide into what they refer to as self-defense, that keep on using the same discourse about alleged terrorism that has been copy-pasted now for years, if not decades. But the question really is about the power relations. And even if we see hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, it is a structural problem in the end, because even at this point, it is the United States, it is Washington, that could put an end to these Israeli crimes if it withdrew its support. So what I want to say is that there are imbalances in power that keep the Israeli regime alive, and also, of course, with it being a proxy and a colonial outpost of the Euro-American sphere.
Sure. You know, while I guess I was speaking there, Chris Williamson, I couldn't help but think, how is Israel going to recoup when this thing, whenever it's going to end, economically? I mean, At this point, the conservative figure is about 11% to 12% GDP drop. There are businesses that they can't even open. They open for a few hours, no customers, they close the doors. In the occupied West Bank, the transportation, which a lot of Palestinians, for example, bus drivers, are cited to just sit around, whereas before, obviously, you know, there was work, there was transportation, people going back and forth. That is something that is not going to fall in back into its original place in a quick fashion. And how is Israel going to be able to come out of that? On top of that, how there's such a strong call coming to boycott Israel. Iran has actually just come out with the Iran's leader saying that, you know, Israel should be boycotted in terms of its oil, that it shouldn't be exported to Israel. Of course, regional countries can contribute to that if there's a will to do that. So what do you think? Can Israel actually come out of the economic doldrums that it's going to be facing?
Well, it's always recovered in the past from these military excursions that it's been engaged in. But I think this is different, and I think it would be much more problematical for them to recover. Because, you know, people are seeing the horror, not so much on the corporate media, but certainly on this channel and on channels like Al Jazeera, etc., but also on social media. And so the propaganda that has been, you know, put out there by Israel and by its willing sort of collaborators in the Western media and political class isn't actually cutting through to people. So I think the desire, the willingness, the commitment to engage in boycotts will certainly increase. We've seen, and you mentioned Bolivia, I think that is likely to increase as well, this kind of breaking off of any kind of diplomatic ties with the Zionist entity. So that will also have an effect. But of course, you know, Israel is imploding anyway. I mean, you know, there's a lot of discontent with the Netanyahu regime. And there was a poll conducted for the Israeli TV channel before the latest Palestinian uprising in Gaza, suggesting the 28% of the Israeli population were considering leaving. Now, that will have only increased substantially, I think, as a result of the, incursion, you know, the Al-Aqsa flood incursion, and what's happening now. The Iron Dome is not as impervious as it previously was. So I think, you know, it will potentially collapse with the weight of discontent internally and the strength of opposition, which is worldwide now.
All right. Thank you so much. We are fortunately out of time. Chris Williamson, host of Palestine Declassified. Daniel Jedzic, author and researcher from Beirut. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for being with us. And I thank the team also. For now, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump's children are testifying in the Trump's Organization $250 million fraud trial in New York. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. The Trump Organization's $250 million civil fraud trial became a family affair on Wednesday, 1st of November, when Donald Trump Jr. became the first of former President Donald Trump's children to take the witness stand. The trial, which is now in its fifth week, centers on allegations that Donald Trump and his business fraudulently inflated his net worth to get better loans, secure insurance deals, and burnish his reputation as a highly successful businessman. Donald Trump, who has blasted the trial as being politically motivated, denies all wrongdoing and has appealed a pre-trial ruling that he used fraudulent statements to do business. New York's Attorney General Letitia James initially named the three Trump children, who served as Trump Organization executive vice presidents, Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump, and Ivanka Trump, as defendants in her lawsuit, alleging that they were intimately involved in operating the family's business. The public desire to inflate his net worth was well known amongst his children, Letitia James alleged in her complaint. Trump's daughter, Ivanka Trump, was subsequently dismissed from the Attorney General's lawsuit in June because she was no longer with the firm by 2016. The three children are each scheduled to testify in the trial over the coming week, beginning with Donald Trump Jr., who testified on Wednesday, 1st of November. Donald Trump's other son, Eric Trump, will also testify, and that will be followed by Ivanka Trump, who will serve as the state's final witness. An ardent defender of his father on the campaign trail and on social media, Trump Jr. is expected to face questions about his role managing Donald Trump's revocable trust, the mechanism his father used to prevent potential business conflicts while he was president. In that capacity, Donald Trump Jr. certified the accuracy of financial statements between 2016 and 2021, each of which is alleged by the Attorney General to have been inflated. New York Attorney General Letitia James alleges that Trump Jr. was particularly involved in the commercial leasing of 40 Wall Street, one of the properties that Judge Arthur Engoron has already decided was overvalued in Trump's financial statements by more than $300 million. Trump Jr. could also face questions about why financial statements allegedly inflated the value of rent-stabilized units in the Trump Park Avenue building by 700%, ignoring the fixed rent of the unit's low-income residents. According to Letitia James, Donald Trump Jr. remarked that the rent-stabilized tenants in Trump's Park Avenue building were the bane of his existence for quite some time. When co-defendants and former Trump Organization executives Aaron Weisselberg and Jeffrey McConney took the stand earlier in the trial, both said that Donald Trump Jr. was not personally involved in the preparation of his father's statement of financial condition, the allegedly fraudulent document that underpins the state's case. There was never a material misrepresentation made by Eric Trump or Donald Trump Jr., their lawyer Clifford Roberts said during his opening statement. However, Alan Weisselberg also testified that Donald Trump Jr. and his siblings became more involved in running the Trump Organization once their father became president in 2016, and that they received documents showing the internal finances of the company. They wanted to get up to speed on how the business was running, Alan Weisselberg testified. Emails from Donald Trump Jr. have been included in evidence presented during the trial, including a 2017 email chain from the Trump Organization's general counsel about the value of Trump's triplex apartment in Trump Tower in New York. The forwarded email included a list of issues raised by a Forbes magazine reporter about Donald Trump's financial claims, including Trump's claim that his penthouse was three times larger than his actual size of 10,996 square feet. Insane amount of stuff there, Donald Trump Jr. replied to the email. Despite the error being called out, Donald Trump Jr. and Alan Weisselberg still signed off on Trump's 2016 financial statement that falsely claimed Trump's triplex apartment was 30,000 square feet and worth $327 million. Ahead of his testimony, Trump Jr. has criticized the trial as a sham being held in a kangaroo court. Another national broadcaster, NBC News, has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump's sons are taking center stage at the $250 million civil fraud trial against the Trump family and their company in New York this week. Donald Trump Jr. took the stand on Wednesday, 1st of November. The oldest son of the former president was grilled by lawyers from State Attorney General Letitia James's office about his involvement in and his knowledge of financial statements that the Attorney General alleges were grossly inflated. His testimony will be followed by that of his brother, Eric Trump, who is expected to testify on Thursday, with their father, the former President Donald Trump, taking the stand next Monday. His testimony will be followed by his daughter, Ivanka Trump's. Letitia James's office claims that Trump's children were aware of and knowingly participated in a long-running scheme to falsely inflate the company's assets in order to land loans and insurance policies on more favorable terms than they were entitled to. The three and their father have denied any wrongdoing, and an appeals court ordered Ivanka Trump to be dropped as a defendant in the case, finding the claims against her were too old. The children were executive vice presidents at the Trump Organization, the real estate company owned by their father, but Ivanka Trump left the company to join her father in the White House. Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump, and then Chief Financial Officer Alan Weisselberg formally took charge of the company after Donald Trump was elected president. Alan Weisselberg was removed from his post as a top trustee in 2021, after he was indicted on tax fraud charges. He later pleaded guilty and testified against the company at a related criminal trial. Donald Trump Jr.'s testimony focused on his involvement with the company's statements of financial condition, documents the company shared with banks and insurers that the Attorney General alleges wildly overvalued their assets and properties. When his father was in office, Donald Trump Jr. and Alan Weisselberg were the ones responsible for signing off on the company's statements, representing them as accurate and having been compiled in accordance with the accepted accounting practices. Letitia James's office alleges neither of those representations are true. The Attorney General is also expected to question Donald Trump Jr. about his role in the valuations of certain Trump properties, including an apartment building on Park Avenue in Manhattan that was valued at $292 million, which the Attorney General said in court filings is roughly six times the appraised value of the property. The court filing also noted that one of the apartments in the building was valued at $25 million, even though Ivanka Trump, who'd been renting it, had an option to buy it for just $8.5 million.
lullaby, my darling. Lullaby, my son. Sleep in peace. Sleep in silence. I've dug the earth with my hands, my bare hands. I've searched for my roots in this soil, this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, now I offer my son to you. See, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms. I put him on your chest, still in red, to water you. My roots, Palestine, 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 Lullaby, my child, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear. Sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since somebody inside my aching heart, somebody inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots we hear, this land.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel continues its intense bombings around several hospitals in northern Gaza Strip as the death toll from the regime's genocidal war nears 10,000. And Iran urges the BRICS members to take active and constructive steps to stop Israel's war crimes against Palestinians. Hello, everyone, from the studios in Tehran. Thank you for joining us.